She drove away, off to market. I listened to the waves, started worrying about how high they might be getting. So I hugged the courtyard wall and looped all the way around it to the seaward side, found my little dip in the rocks. The weed stalks around it were wet and bedraggled. The dip was full of water. It was rainwater, not seawater. It was safely above the tide. The waves hadn't reached it. But rainwater was all it was full of. Apart from the water, it was completely empty. No bundle, no rag, no Glock. The spare magazines were gone, Doll's keys were gone, the bradawl was gone, and the chisel was gone. Chapter 8. I came around to the front of the house and faced west, and stood in the lashing rain and stared at the high stone wall. Right at that moment, I came as close as I ever got to bailing out. It would have been easy. The gate was wide open. I guessed the maid had left it that way. She had gotten out in the rain to open it, and she hadn't wanted to get out again to close it. Paulie wasn't there to do it for her. He was out driving the Cadillac. So the gate was open and unguarded. The first time I had ever seen it that way. I could have slipped straight through it. But I didn't. I stayed. Time was part of the reason. Beyond the gate was at least 12 miles of empty road before the first significant turning. 12 miles, and there were no cars to use. The Becks were out in the Cadillac, and the maid was out in the Saab. We had abandoned the Lincoln in Connecticut, so I would be on foot. 3 hours, fast walk. I didn't have 3 hours. Almost certainly the Cadillac would return within 3 hours, and there was nowhere to hide on the road. The shoulders were bare and rocky. It was an exposed situation. Beck would pass me head on. I would be walking. He would be in a car. And he had a gun. And Paulie. I had nothing. Therefore, strategy was part of the reason, too. To be caught in the act of walking away would confirm whatever Beck might think he knew, assuming it was Beck who had discovered the stash. But if I stayed, I had some kind of a chance. Staying would imply innocence. I could deflect suspicion onto Duke. I could say it must have been Duke's stash. Beck might find that plausible. Maybe. Duke had enjoyed the freedom to go wherever he wanted, any time of night or day. I had been locked up and supervised the whole time. And Duke wasn't around anymore to deny anything. But I would be right there in Beck's face, talking loud and fast and persuasive. He might buy it. Hope was part of the reason, too. Maybe it wasn't Beck who had found the stash. Maybe it was Richard, walking the shoreline. His reaction would be unpredictable. I figured it at 50-50 whether he would approach me or his father first. Or maybe it was Elizabeth who had found it. She was familiar with the rocks out there. She knew them well, knew their secrets. I guessed she had spent plenty of time on them, for one reason or another, and her reaction would favor me. Probably. The rain was part of the reason for staying, too. It was cold and hard and relentless. I was too tired to road march 3 hours in the rain. I knew it was just weakness, but I couldn't move my feet. I wanted to go back inside the house. I wanted to get warm and eat again and rest. Fear of failure was part of the reason, too. If I walked away now, I would never come back. I knew that. And I had invested 2 weeks. I had made good progress. People were depending on me. I had been beaten many times, but I had never just quit. Not once. Not ever. If I quit now, it would eat me up the rest of my days. Jack Reacher. Quitter. Walked away when the going got tough. I stood there with the rain driving against my back. Time, strategy, hope, the weather, fear of failure. All parts of the reason for staying, all right there on the list. But top of the list was a woman. Not Susan Duffy. Not Teresa Daniel. A woman from long ago, from another life. She was called Dominique Cole. I was a captain in the Army when I met her. I was 1 year away from my final promotion to major. I got to my office early one morning and found the usual stack of paperwork on my desk. Most of it was junk. But among it was a copy of an order assigning an E-7 Sergeant First Class D.E. Cole to my unit. Back then, we were in a phase where all written references to personnel had to be gender neutral. The name Cole sounded German to me, and I pictured some big, ugly guy from Texas or Minnesota. Big red hands, big red face, older than me, maybe 35, with a white wall haircut. Later in the morning, the clerk buzzed through to say the guy was reporting for duty. I made him wait 10 minutes, just for the fun of it, and then called him in. But the him was a her, and she wasn't big and ugly. She was wearing a skirt. She was about 29 years old. She wasn't tall, but she was too athletic to be called petite, and she was too pretty to be called athletic. It was like she had been exquisitely molded from the stuff they make the inside of tennis balls out of. There was an elasticity about her, a firmness and a softness all at the same time. She looked sculpted, but she had no hard edges. She stood rigidly at attention in front of my desk and snapped a smart salute. I didn't return it, which was rude of me. I just stared at her for 5 whole seconds. At ease, Sergeant. She handed me her copy of her orders and her personnel file. We called them service jackets. They contained everything anybody needed to know. I left her standing easy in front of me while I read hers through, which was rude of me, too. But there was no other option. I didn't have a visitor's chair. Back then, the Army didn't provide them below the rank of full colonel. She stood completely still, hands clasped behind her back, staring at a point in the air exactly a foot above my head. Her jacket was impressive. She had done a little of everything and succeeded at it all in spectacular fashion. Expert marksman, specialist in a number of skills, tremendous arrest record, excellent clear-up percentage. She was a good leader and had been promoted fast. She had killed 2 people, one with a firearm, one unarmed. Both incidents rated righteous by the subsequent investigating panels. She was a rising star. That was clear. I realized that her transfer represented a substantial compliment to me, in some superior's mind. "Glad to have you aboard," I said.
"Sir, thank you, sir," she said, with her eyes fixed in space.
"I don't do all that shit. I'm not afraid I'm going to vaporize if you look at me, and I don't really like one sir in a sentence, let alone 2, okay?"
"Okay," she said.
She caught on fast. She never called me sir again. The whole rest of her life.